Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone requires assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop, highlights from the 2016 American Society of Clinical Oncology ASCO Annual Meeting, and this is part two of a two-part series. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And really, this is a highlight of our programs each year. I think that all of you wait to hear these updates, and it's really right on the heels of ASCO, so it's really quite hot off the press, the information you're getting, and you're hearing it from the lead experts in the field. So because of all that, we have over 664 participants on the call today, and you come from all of the United States, and we have international participants from Canada, China, France, Italy, the Netherlands, the Philippines, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So it's really a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Now, today's program and this whole entire workshop series has been made possible by AbbVie, Ariad Pharmaceuticals, Inc., contribution from Lilly, the Celgene Corporation, Gilead, a grant from Genentech, and an unrestricted educational grant from Insight, and a grant from Novartis Oncology. And I really want to thank them for their support of this entire series and for their corporate partnership and support of this particular program and the series. And I'd like to now begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Mark Crist. And Dr. Crist is attending physician, Thoracic Oncology Service, the William and Joy Rang Chair in Thoracic Oncology, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Crist is going to present highlights from ASCO on lung cancer. And it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Crist.
Thank you, Carolyn. So welcome all our guests today. I will try to pass along some of the excitement of the meeting of the American Society of Clinical Oncology that concluded a week ago today. If I could take a theme in the fight against lung cancers, I think it's the number of treatments that have become available and the number of treatments that have the potential to help an individual with fighting lung cancer. Back a few years ago, you would get chemotherapy, you'd have an operation, you may have radiation, but now more and more, no matter what stage of lung cancer is discovered, it's very likely you're going to get a recommendation for many, many different kinds of treatments, and I'll try to update you on developments that happened at ASCO. I think the first one, and probably the one that hit the news the most, is the continued excitement about immune treatments. So these treatments are really fundamentally different than our usual cancer treatments. You know, the radiation kills the cancer cell. The surgery cuts out the cancer cell. The chemotherapy kills the cancer cell. These immune drugs don't do that. What they do is they allow your own immune system to turn on and your own immune cells to kill the cancer cells. So it's a whole different way of fighting cancer, and as things go today, it appears to be something relevant to all kinds of thoracic cancers at all stages, all times, and I think that's one of the most exciting things about it is that no matter what stage or type of cancer that you have, that these drugs can potentially be helpful. There were a number of presentations about using the immune-targeted drugs in combination. Two drugs in particular, ipilimumab and nivolumab, when used together, again, a common regimen used in the fight against melanoma, skin cancer, it's been found to be very helpful in lung cancers as well. And in the patients with adenocarcinoma and squamous carcinoma, work was done to try to fine-tune the doses and schedules of this combination immune treatment to make it not only very effective, but also much less in terms of side effects. And I think the data presented at ASCO this year showed that by giving the nivolumab every 2 weeks and the ipilimumab at a slightly lower dose every 6 weeks, it becomes a much more tolerable regimen. The results were very, very impressive, particularly in those patients that had testing of their tumors to find the presence of certain proteins that would say that these immune treatments would be beneficial, something called PD-L1. The other interesting thing that was presented was that some patients that have been on these drugs for several years, we have started to remove whatever was left after many years of treatment, and the spots that we had been treating went under the microscope did not show any evidence of cancer. So I think everybody was very excited that for those patients that have a good result, that result lasts for years. When you examine those spots that we've been following on scans, there's no cancer there. There was data that this same immune approach works with small cell lung cancer. There was data that it works with mesothelioma, and I think we're all very hopeful that these drugs more and more are going to be used in virtually every patient with a thoracic cancer, and I think some of the other speakers today would be talking about using these drugs in other cancers as well. The other major development that was highlighted was the first ever comparison trial of two drugs that work against the same target. As you know, we've discovered that there are genetic drivers of lung cancers. When you find these drivers present in an individual person's cancer cells, we can then recommend certain drugs that directly target that driver. The poster child for this has been the EGFR mutation and treatment with a drug like erlotinib, gefitinib, or afatinib. But there's another kind of genetic abnormality, what they call a translocation of the ALK gene, ALK gene. And we have three drugs available now, a drug called alectinib, a drug called crizotinib, and a drug called ceritinib. All of them work. They work for many months. The side effects are much less than many comparable therapies, and it's just been a great thing. And very often, after crizotinib fails to work, or stops working, rather, these other drugs can lead to additional benefit. The trial that was presented at ASCO, though, was slightly different. It compared the initial treatment of these ALK-positive cancers, and it compared people getting crizotinib, the standard treatment, versus alectinib, one of the newer treatments. And what they found was the proportion of cancers that shrunk were greater with alectinib. The time that the cancer shrunk was longer before the cancer eventually regrew with alectinib, that the number of side effects was less. And I think the conclusion of the authors and the doctors that came to discuss this study said that alectinib is soon to become the new standard of care for the initial treatment of ALK-positive lung cancers. I would concur with this. These are concepts that are going through the oncology community now. This was presented only a week ago yesterday, but I do believe that within a matter of weeks that this approach is going to be available throughout the U.S., and it's very likely that alectinib will replace crizotinib as the first treatment. Also presented was a fourth agent, a drug called brigantinib, now under evaluation by the FDA, so it's very likely we'll have a fourth drug in this space as well. So good news. We're now able to have choices among the effective drugs, and I think this type of trial will be a model for trials in years to come, where we're going to be trying to find, when we have multiple drug choices, choosing the best drug. I know folks have been trying to turn their attention away from chemotherapy, but just some reminders that if you look at all the different treatments that have helped the majority of people with advanced lung cancers, chemotherapy is still the winner in that department. Chemotherapy also, in conjunction with surgery or radiation, can improve the rate of cure, whereas none of the targeted or immune therapies have yet been able to show that. What was presented was a trial from France for a combination of two available drugs, paclitaxel and bevacizumab. And they compared those two drugs together versus another useful drug, docetaxel. What they found was the patients that received paclitaxel and bevacizumab had more shrinkages. The shrinkages persisted longer, and the side effects were pretty comparable, actually, to the docetaxel by itself. So what the French doctors showed us was another combination that could be used after initial therapy stopped working or had to be stopped for in terms of a side effect. So this we've added now to the list of agents that we have, the combination of paclitaxel and bevacizumab. Another development that is already here and had much discussion in ASCO is the ability to do testing on tumor tissue, not by doing a biopsy of that tumor tissue, but instead by looking for the tumor's DNA found in the person's blood. The testing has become so sophisticated now that the DNA that gets shed from the tumor into the bloodstream is sufficient enough to give you the genetic fingerprint of those cancer cells so that patients would not need a biopsy. This technology is available to doctors around the country. Actually, the Food and Drug Administration, just a few days before the ASCO meeting, approved a blood test for patients with EGFR mutant lung cancers so that they could have their diagnosis of EGFR mutant cancer made and treatment decided by a blood test rather than a biopsy. I think we're going to see these tests used more and more. The nice thing about it is for patients that don't have sufficient tissue or can't have a biopsy for some reason, this is a way around that. Also, the turnaround time is much less. It's days rather than weeks for a biopsy. So I think this is going to be a great advance in care. I have in my institution has been part of a 16 hospital group across the United States to do this comprehensive molecular testing of tissue. There was a presentation from our group that showed this testing could be done, that in the majority of patients were able to find some kind of a molecular signature of the patient's cancer that would lead us to a specific therapy. And what happened is as we found additional targets for therapy, we're able to very quickly assay them and add them to these comprehensive platforms. The presentation by the Lung Cancer Mutation Consortium showed that could happen. And then, again, the nice thing is that whenever a new discovery happens, it can be quickly added, like within a matter of days, frankly, to these molecular panels and be done with no additional time, virtually no additional cost, and with no additional requirement for another biopsy. So I think that was more good news that we're going to be able to get this information more comprehensively and with less invasive means. Along those lines, it was noted within the last few years that there's a certain gene, MET, and if this gene has a mutation in it, it means that cancer would be sensitive to a drug that targets the MET gene, MET gene. And we have that drug available already. That drug is crizotinib. And what we saw at this meeting was that patients that had this MET gene abnormality in their tumor tissue who received crizotinib had their cancer shrink, for many, many months into years, and did so with a treatment that was very well tolerated. And again, the beautiful thing is the drug is there if you have this MET mutation, and the ability to test for it is there if you have this standard testing. So I think we heard a lot of good news at ASCO this year. I think the most important take-home message is that there are more ways to fight cancer arising from the chest. There are ways that are available to virtually all kinds of cancer, more and more your doctors are going to be approaching you with more choices, more options. The data from ASCO is that those additional choices and options lead to better outcomes, and our hope is that as the years go on, we're just going to have more and more things to offer and mainly to be offering patients a longer life and not losing sight of the goal. What we really want to do is knock out these cancers once and for all. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Chris. It was a wonderful way to start off the program today and excellent presentation and very inspiring. So thank you very much and lots of good news here. So thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Al B. Benson III. Dr. Benson is Professor of Medicine, Associate Director for Cooperative Groups, Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center of Northwestern University. And Dr. Benson is going to present highlights from ASCO on colorectal cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Benson.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and indeed it's a pleasure to join everyone today to talk about colorectal cancer. I'm first going to start with just a little bit of background to give a perspective. So over the past 12 years in particular, we've really had very significant advances in the treatment of metastatic colorectal cancer. We now have 11 approved anti-cancer agents that are routinely available. These include 5 chemotherapy agents and 6 so-called biological or targeted therapies that can literally be given in hundreds of different combinations. And absolutely, this has resulted in improved outcomes for patients with metastatic disease. The idea of precision or targeted treatment is increasingly emphasized, and this concept is based on specific patient characteristics, in particular, the biology of the tumor, such as genetic changes within the tumor. And now we routinely test colorectal cancer patients with metastatic disease for 4 such genetic changes. These include what's called microsatellite instability, also known as MSI, also referred to as mismatch repair. There's also evaluation looking for KRAS to determine if a patient is what we call wild type or mutated, also NRAS, and then the 4th is BRAF. And these are important in our ability to make some treatment decisions. This year's recent ASCO meeting continued the dialogue centered around increasing patient selection for treatment based on tumor biology, and there was a focus on the potential of immunotherapy to improve outcomes for patients. Dr. Chris just spoke about immunotherapy, and immunotherapy is a research interest across various cancers that holds increasing promise based on the technical advances leading to a better understanding of human immunology, plus the development of new drugs that can enhance an immunologic response to better control metastatic disease, at least for some patients, but unfortunately not for all patients. Thus, we still have much more to learn about immunotherapy. At ASCO, there were a number of presentations relative to the treatment of metastatic colorectal cancer, including tumor biology and immunotherapy. It is estimated that approximately 4% of metastatic colorectal cancer patients will have what's known as high microsatellite instability, which is a biological phenomenon well suited for an immunotherapeutic approach. We also think that there are MSI high-like tumors which might benefit from immunotherapy, perhaps when given in combinations with other biologics or chemotherapy or radiation. At ASCO, one abstract evaluated a 2-drug immunologic combination for metastatic colorectal cancer patients who had received previous treatment with or without having microsatellite instability high tumors. And this included using the drug nivolumab, which is known as an anti-PD-1 monoclonal antibody, with or without the agent ipilimumab, which is known as an anti-CTLA-4 monoclonal antibody, So two different immunological therapies. And this initial combination type study showed some very encouraging results for the MSIH group. And so this will lead to further investigation with these agents for this group of patients. There was another early phase study with the immunotherapeutic agent referred to as atezolizumab. These agents are really hard to pronounce, but atezolizumab, which is combined with cobimetinib, and cobimetinib actually targets a different biological pathway known as MET. And with this combination, there were responses seen in patients who did not have MSI tumors. And so this is an example of how we can take a biological target in a tumor and try to enhance an immunologic therapeutic response by giving a combination approach. And these early data are of great interest, and I'm sure more work will continue with this type of approach. Also, past observations have noted that people with right-sided colon cancers have different outcomes compared to those with left-sided tumors. This makes some sense because when we develop in the uterus as embryos, the left and right-sided colon tumors develop separately. And so they may well have very different biological profiles. And in fact, most recently, molecular biological differences have been described between left and right-sided tumors, which identify tumors that are potentially responsive to immunotherapies and those which might not respond as well to current chemotherapies or other biologic agents. At ASCO this year, there were several presentations addressing right versus left colon tumors and the biological differences between these two sides of the colon. One study was from a very large NCI GI intergroup trial known as 80405 for patients with KRAS wild-type tumors that showed that the right versus left colon tumors were clinically very different and that there appears to be differences in the benefits of the biologic agent cetuximab, which is dependent on the actual location of tumor. And so this work just lends more credibility to the fact that there are differences, and we're going to really have to start paying attention to these differences that may have a direct impact on which therapies we consider to offer patients. Another study of patients with all stages of colorectal cancer also showed differences in prognosis dependent on tumor location for people who had stages 3 and 4 colorectal cancer. These differences emphasize, again, the importance of looking carefully at the location of the tumor and the biologic differences, particularly as we think about designing new clinical trials, and also it emphasizes the need to conduct further research in this area. And so increasingly, we're going to need to ask patients for tumor specimens so that we can confirm these past biological differences and link them to how well people might or might not respond to a given therapeutic approach. But also, this will enhance our understanding of the tumor biology of the colon. Finally, there was yet another study, in this case it performed molecular analyses on colorectal tumors that were known to be KRAS wild type. And this analysis also showed differences in outcome after treatment with the anti-EGFR therapy, such as the drug cetuximab. And these biological differences were noted, including those patients who had BRAF mutations, right-sided colon tumors, and also the biological phenomenon, what is noted as CpG island methylator phenotype. And yet another example of why biology is important. So I think to conclude, we can say we are in a very exciting era of cancer treatment for metastatic colorectal cancer. And these few studies that I just reviewed are offering new strategies to better define treatment for patients. And it also emphasizes how our clinical trials, although they may have been conducted even a few years ago, they keep on giving because we can go back, we can look at tissues, we can look at some of these new biologic observations and make comparisons. And with some of the studies I presented, that's exactly what happened. We were able to go back, look at the characteristics of the patients who participated, and make these biological observations. So I would like to conclude with emphasis that our research continues to be fruitful, and we certainly need participation by our clinicians as well as our patients in conducting these type of studies. So thanks very much for your attention today.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Benson. That was really excellent and very interesting and a lot of information for everyone and clearly a lot of advances in the treatment of colorectal cancer and advanced colorectal cancer. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Eileen O'Reilly. Dr. O'Reilly is Associate Director, Clinical Research, David M. Rubenstein Center for Pancreatic Cancer, Attending Physician, Member of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. O'Reilly is going to present highlights from ASCO on pancreatic cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. O'Reilly.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to update us on what happened at ASCO this year in pancreas cancer. I would say that the main news pertains to the management of postoperative pancreas cancer, so what's called adjuvant therapy. This is treatment that we administer after people have undergone surgical removal of their pancreas. And a large European trial called the ESPAC-4 study from our UK colleagues had data presented. We've been waiting for this for a number of years. This trial involved about 700 patients, and it was evaluating the addition of an oral drug called capecitabine to a standard drug called gemcitabine, and gemcitabine is the main standard that we use in the postoperative setting. And there was a very simple question: does the combination of two drugs improve outcome compared to one drug on its own? And the nice news is that it does, and that this appears to be a meaningful improvement in outcome for people, and that this combination of gemcitabine and this oral medication called capecitabine will likely become a new reference and standard option for people who've undergone surgery. The treatment is given over 6 months, starting anywhere between 6 and 12 weeks after surgery, depending on how a person recovers. Gemcitabine is given once a week for 3 weeks out of four and then dosed over 6 months, and the oral medication capecitabine is dosed twice a day for 3 weeks out of four. Main things that patients noted in the study was fatigue, some dryness of the hands and feet, low blood counts, and occasionally diarrhea and some soreness in the mouth. But overall, this was quite a tolerable combination. and is set to change practice. And just to note that there are other combinations that are being looked at in the postoperative setting as well. For example, combining a drug called nab-paclitaxel to gemcitabine. That combination is widely used for people who have metastatic pancreas cancer where it is spread. But we don't know yet whether that serves the same purpose in the postoperative setting. So we'll have data on that in the next couple of years. And similarly, a combination of drugs called FOLFIRINOX, which involves a drug called 5-FU, a drug called irinotecan, a drug called oxaliplatin, and a vitamin called leucovorin. That combination is also being compared to gemcitabine, and we're also waiting data on that. So the good news is that there's real change afront here and potential further change to come in the next couple of years. And everything that we've discussed so far relates to the post-operative setting. So moving to a slightly different topic, colleagues again from the UK conducted another very nice study looking at the role of a PET scan in the diagnosis or the suspected diagnosis of pancreas cancer. So a PET scan is an imaging test where we give people a sugar molecule, and essentially malignant cells or inflammatory cells will take up this molecule, so it can allow discrimination of a benign finding from a malignant finding often. It can help to stage the cancer, so determine whether a cancer is localized or has spread. It can facilitate planning for surgery. So there's some potential advantages to using a PET CT, that's a PET combined with a CT, over a CT scan on its own. And the bottom line is here that there did appear to be incremental benefits for adding a PET CT in a suspected diagnosis of pancreas cancer, in that it was shown to alter the staging, to avoid surgery where that was deemed not to be helpful for a particular person, to guide management, and also from a UK analysis perspective, it had some quality of life and cost effectiveness benefits. So we will adapt this in a way as we're considering a diagnosis of pancreas cancer. I wouldn't say it's going to be used for everybody, because often CT provides optimal information, but for a percentage of people it may add in terms of staging. So that's a helpful tool that now has solid data behind it regarding its use in a suspected diagnosis of pancreas cancer. So moving to a different topic, that of metastatic pancreas cancer and drug development in that setting, and again we have some nice news here and some updates. The first update is from a study looking at the evaluation of a drug called PEG-PH20, and I'll explain that in a moment, combined to a commonly used backbone of gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. So in pancreas cancer, there is an environment called the stroma that supports pancreas cells. It has it lacks immune cells. It has a lot of fibrous cells. It has a low oxygen level, low blood vessel level, and we think of it as a sort of a hostile component of the tumor. And it's an important part of treatment targeting. And this drug called PEG-PH20, which is an enzyme, is designed to break down this sort of stromal or physical barrier, as it were, and to try and optimize drug delivery to pancreas cancer cells. So we had some preliminary information last year, and this data was updated this year, that demonstrated that people who have high levels of a component of the stroma called hyaluronan, that they in particular appeared to benefit from the addition of PEG-PH20 to gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. This was a relatively early to mid-phase study. So following the solidification of those results, there's now a large randomized trial, a phase 3 study, which is a potential practice-changing study in people with metastatic disease who have not had prior treatment for their cancer and who have a high level of hyaluronan in the tumor. And that's probably, the estimates are maybe about 40%, maybe a little bit higher, of people with pancreas cancer. So a lot more to come on this topic as the phase 3 trial accrues over the next couple of years. So switching to a different topic in metastatic pancreas cancer, we know that a subset of people will have a change or a mutation in genes that predispose to pancreas cancer called BRCA genes. These are known to be associated more commonly with ovary and breast and prostate cancer, but also predisposed to pancreas cancer. And we know these genes, if they're identified in a particular person, have important implication for that person and their family, but also have implication in terms of treatment and treatment targeting. So there's a class of drugs called PARP inhibitors, which are not approved in pancreas cancer, but which are approved in other disease settings where BRCA changes occur, like ovary cancer. And these drugs are being looked at in pancreas cancer, and we had an example of a drug called rucaparib, some data presented which supports the fact that this may be a key target in pancreas cancer and is a worthwhile approach in terms of treatment if there is a BRCA mutation present. We're learning a lot more about these drugs. We're learning if they can be combined with chemotherapy, which is an attractive concept in pancreas cancer, whether they may be used as a form of maintenance treatment. So after the disease has been controlled with chemotherapy, then as a way of maintaining that control and avoiding some of the side effects of chemotherapy, a plan for a maintenance approach is an interesting strategy in pancreas cancer. And they may also benefit patients by being integrated earlier in the disease course. So not relevant to everybody with pancreas cancer. This is a subset of probably about 5 to 8% of people, but we think it's a key target. And related to that, in pancreas cancer, we had a number of presentations on profiling patients' tumors, so looking at the genetic makeup of these tumors, understanding what genes are changed, understanding how we may use these genetic changes from the treatment approach, and understanding if there are certain patterns of gene changes that relate to certain outcomes, i.e. that, for example, a particular pattern suggests people are more likely to benefit from a particular drug, or another pattern relates more to people who've had a history of smoking, etc. So we have a wealth of data that are being generated from these types of studies that I think will further help refine treatment choices and refine ways of thinking about treatment for people with pancreas cancer. So I'll stop there, and we'll conclude by saying that it's been an exciting year in pancreas cancer. We love to see change, and we love to have more options for patients and their family, and we'll hopefully look forward to updating further in 2017. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Dr. O'Reilly. That was really outstanding and very informative and comprehensive in terms of all of the updates in terms of pancreatic cancer from ASCO. So thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. John Leonard. Dr. Leonard is the Richard T. Silver Distinguished Professor of Hematology and Medical Oncology. He's Associate Dean for Clinical Research, Weill Cornell Medical College, Vice Chairman of Medicine for Clinical Research, Associate Director, Cancer Center, Chief Lymphoma Service, and Attending Physician, New York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. Leonard is going to present highlights from ASCO on lymphoma, and it's my great pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Leonard.
Thank you very much, Dr. Messner. It's a great pleasure to participate again in this type of program for cancer care, which is really a great organization that does a tremendous amount to serve patients as well as educate them regarding new developments such as what we're talking about today. And I also want to thank the other speakers. These have been really great updates, and I hope to carry my end of of the program as well. So the ASCO meeting is one of several meetings across the world, across the country, where blood cancers are presented. You'll hear from some of the other speakers who also represent blood disorders and blood cancers. In the lymphoma area, ASCO tends to have some studies of importance, but it's not the biggest lymphoma meeting that there is, but nonetheless there were several developments presented that I think are important for the audience to know about, particularly those who participate in dealing with lymphoma one way or another. So the first thing I wanted to talk about was a carryover from the prior speakers relating to the immune checkpoint inhibitors. And again, you heard earlier that there are a number of new drugs that are called immune checkpoint inhibitors. And the concept is as you heard, that tumor cells have what one might term a shield on their surface, effectively shielding them from the immune system that the patient has. And therefore, that is one reason why the immune system is unable to eradicate or control cancer in many different situations. And so we have this class of drugs that you heard about that have been very widely developed in a number of different tumors that are these immune checkpoint inhibitors that basically remove the shield or interfere with the shield that is protecting the tumor cell from the immune system. And by treating the patient with these checkpoint inhibitors, the shield comes off, the immune system can do a better job, and in certain scenarios, that can result in an effect against the tumor. So these types of drugs have now been established to have a role in some lymphomas. I would say that across the spectrum of lymphomas, and there are over 80 different types of lymphoma, all different in their characteristics, these types of drugs seem to have generally a modest impact so far, meaning that in a meaningful number of patients, they can shrink the disease and benefit patients, but they are largely in clinical trials in a number of different settings. The one positive exception to that is in Hodgkin lymphoma. Hodgkin lymphoma, also referred to as Hodgkin disease, is about 10% of lymphoma patients have Hodgkin lymphoma. And one of the interesting features about Hodgkin lymphoma is that the bad guys, or the tumor cells, are called Reed-Sternberg cells. But within the lymph nodes or within the malignant tumors, the Reed-Sternberg cells are a very small percentage of the tumor cells. Most of what comprises the tumor mass are immune cells that one might imagine are trying to get rid of the Reed-Sternberg cells but are unable to do so. And so that, for many years, has implicated the immune system or problems with the immune system as being one of the issues in Hodgkin lymphoma. And it now turns out, and we had data presented on this at ASCO, that these immune checkpoint inhibitors, there are two of them that have been widely studied in Hodgkin lymphoma, pembrolizumab and nivolumab. These have been studied in other cancers as well, and you've heard them referenced by the other speakers, can be beneficial in patients with Hodgkin lymphoma. And so the pivotal trial, or the FDA approval trial for nivolumab, one of these drugs in Hodgkin lymphoma, was updated and presented at the ASCO meeting, and that coincides with, in May, nivolumab was approved for patients, for the treatment of patients with Hodgkin lymphoma who had been through prior treatments, including standard treatments such as chemotherapy, autologous stem cell transplant, and another approved drug called brentuximab vedotin, which is an antibody drug conjugate, basically a chemotherapy drug approved hooked to an antibody treatment. And so nivolumab is now FDA approved for this patient population, patients who have been through these prior therapies for the treatment of Hodgkin lymphoma and have had a relapse. And the data on this are that roughly two-thirds of patients in the studies with nivolumab in this patient population had substantial shrinkage of their tumor, and on average this worked for 8 to 9 months. which is a meaningful amount of time in these patients who had been through a number of different prior regimens. And so nivolumab, this immune checkpoint inhibitor, is now approved for patients with recurrent Hodgkin lymphoma fitting these criteria. And again, I think this is a drug that we'll see more of, like you've heard about in this, in various solid tumors. We'll see more of that in Hodgkin lymphoma as well as other lymphomas altogether. Another drug that we saw some data on was presented by my colleague Adrian Phillips here at Weill Cornell. And this was another antibody treatment. Antibodies are immune proteins that bind to different targets, either on the immune cells or on tumor cells themselves, and through a variety of different ways can have an effect against the tumor. So Dr. Phillips and her colleagues presented data for a very rare type of lymphoma called ATLL, acute T-cell leukemia and lymphoma. This is a type of lymphoma that does not respond well to standard treatments, to chemotherapy. It's an area where we need new drugs. It is an uncommon type of leukemia lymphoma, seen in a relatively small percentage of people around the world, but it is a bit more common in parts of the Caribbean, parts of South America, and as well as in Asia. And in fact, many of the people in the U.S. who have been affected by ATLL often are people who have come to the U.S. from those parts of the world, interestingly. And so this study used a drug, another, again, antibody drug that binds to something called CCR4. CCR4 is a protein on immune cells. It's also on these bad guys, these T cells in this ATLL disorder. And the drug is called mogamuluzumab. It's an anti-CCR4 antibody. Again, mogamuluzumab. It's a tongue twister of a name. But the net is that in this relatively small randomized trial where this antibody treatment for ATLL was compared to chemotherapy, it appeared to have a very clear benefit with respect to the number of patients that responded to the treatment and the duration that the response occurred. So this is a challenging disease for many people, ATLL, and we now have a new drug that demonstrates clear benefit. This is a drug that had been approved in Japan, and I'm hopeful that we'll see that more widely available in the U.S. in the future. So again, an uncommon disease, but a disease that really needed new treatment, and we have one that seems to be having an impact. Another, I think, high-impact study, or an important study, in the B-cell lymphomas related to maintenance rituximab. Rituximab is an anti-CD20 antibody and immune protein that is widely used for the treatment for patients with B-cell type lymphomas. Often patients are treated with rituximab alone for a B-cell type of lymphoma. Often it's given with chemotherapy. And in some places, it's used as a maintenance therapy after treatment. And there are certain studies that have shown that in indolent lymphoma and follicular lymphoma in particular, that maintenance rituximab after chemotherapy or after rituximab may have some benefit if patients take it for a prolonged period of time. And there's a lot of back and forth around that. The study that was presented at ASCO was a small randomized trial taking older patients with a subset of B-cell lymphoma called mantle cell lymphoma. And those patients were treated with a regimen called bendamustine and rituximab. Bendamustine is a chemotherapy drug. Rituximab is the aforementioned antibody treatment. And studied whether or not maintenance rituximab, meaning additional rituximab given over 2 years as a maintenance therapy, benefited patients. And there have been contradictory studies one way or another with different regimens, different scenarios, suggesting that in mantle cell with different chemotherapy regimens, this could be of benefit. And the net of this smaller study, non-definitive study, I would say, was that maintenance rituximab in this trial did not appear to have a benefit. And so this is one scenario where doctors in practice may be changing their approach to mantle cell lymphoma or may not be, based on this study that perhaps questions the the possible benefit of maintenance rituximab in mantle cell lymphoma. Personally, I think the jury is still out. I don't think this study is definitive, but those patients out there dealing with mantle cell lymphoma may want to speak to their doctor about the use of maintenance therapy if they're getting treatment, and also keep in mind that this was in mantle cell lymphoma. The situation may be different in other types of B-cell lymphomas. In the last minute, I just want to mention one very interesting abstract presented by Dr. Geeta Thanaras-Jassingham. She's a faculty member at Mayo Clinic. And this was a study referencing a new strategy. This has been looked at in colon cancer, and one study of colon cancer is now being applied to lymphoma. And she reported on her data in lymphoma. The idea is that, as patients know, you can take a drug over a period of time and you may have a side effect. And when we as researchers do clinical trials, we measure, did you have the side effect? How severe was it? What we don't do a good job of is measuring how long it lasts and what that effect is over time. And for a patient that may have a side effect for one day, versus 1 month versus 1 year, obviously the implications of that side effect may be very different if it lasts a day versus a month versus a year with regard to quality of life. And so what these researchers did was to try to take this tool and apply it to some of our clinical trials to capture not only the severity of the toxicity, but the impact of the toxicity over time. And this was a very interesting study that I think outlined that this could be a useful tool. And honestly, I really do believe that this sort of strategy will be very important going forward as patients take various therapies, including oral therapies, over time to get a better feel for the patient and the physician to be able to sort through, is this toxicity simply a one-time thing, or is this a toxicity that patients will be living with over weeks or months or years that would have a major impact on their quality of life? And this sort of information may be helpful in helping patients and physicians make choices between one therapy or another, or the relative value of a therapy as we capture not only its efficacy but its toxicity over time. And so I think this is good news for patients, and I think the summary of the lymphoma data in mantle cell lymphoma, in lymphoma in general from ASCO, is that we're now getting more tools not only to treat our patients better in many situations, but also to measure the outcomes for our patients to help people make better informed decisions as to what therapy they would like to choose in an individual situation. So with that, I'll stop, and thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you so much, Dr. Leonard. That was really wonderful and very, very comprehensive and just informative, and lots of new things for people with lymphoma, and so I thank you for that, all that information, and right from ASCO, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow. Dr. Morrow is leader of Myeloproliferative Neoplasms Program, attending physician, leukemia service. He's member of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor of medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Morrow is going to present highlights from ASCO on leukemia. And it's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Morrow.
Thanks, Carolyn, and thank you all for your endurance in holding up as we continue to update you across different cancer types and things that we learned at ASCO this year. I want to thank you all for joining the teleconference. Thank Carolyn for the invitation, and these are just a great way for us to spread the word about news and good advice, good counsel, as you just heard from many of my colleagues, and I learn a lot by listening to my colleagues talk about things that we all can't get to every session of these meetings. But let me share with you some thoughts from what was presented regarding leukemia at ASCO. And again, we have major meetings in throughout the year, and perhaps ASH is a meeting where leukemia is a bit more highlighted. But certainly we learned things at ASCO this year. And I'll cover a few different disease areas. I want to speak a little bit about AML, or acute myeloid leukemia, about ALL, CML, and a rare cancer, which may not be heard of much, but which has some exciting therapeutic options. So starting with AML, we saw a few reports of novel therapies, and one was using a drug called Venclexta, or venetoclax, which you probably saw or heard about in chronic lymphocytic leukemia. So this is a drug that targets something called BCL2, which is a protein that cancer cells use to prevent themselves from undergoing organized natural death and shorten. It extends their lifespan when the cancer cell lifespan shouldn't be too long. This is something that's overactive in chronic lymphocytic leukemia, leukemia stem cells, acute myeloid leukemia. And this drug's shown some promise at our most recent ASH meeting in AML by being combined with medications we would commonly use called hypomethylating agents. It was a very promising study with good response for patients of somewhat older age who may not be able to or might not be able to tolerate standard chemotherapy we might use for acute myeloid leukemia. So what was presented was a combination with low doses of a chemotherapy drug called cytarabine, which is a common approach in AML. And I think what we're seeing is that this drug is now crossing the border and is able to really show activity both in lymphoid cancers and myeloid cancers based on a common protein in cancer cells that is preventing them from being eliminated or going through the normal process of cell death. So with an oral drug, venetoclax, and a subcutaneous administration of cytarabine, with moderate side effects, folks of older age with AML had a significant minority of patients were able to gain response, which is very important. It was offer a lower toxicity and an efficacious option for AML. And I thought this was very encouraging. So I think that's a drug to look out for, both in myeloid and lymphoid leukemias. That drug was, as you may know, was just approved for CLL, and again, it's really showing us how our targeted therapies have often multiple applications. Another exciting update was building on earlier reports of a different way of delivering our chemotherapy. So we have two medicines we use in AML. The combination is called 7 and 3. It's 7 days of one medicine and 3 days of another. And the two drugs are what are called an anthracycline and the drug I just mentioned called cytarabine. But one company developed a way to say maybe we need to deliver the drug to the leukemia cells in just the right amount and more efficiently. So the right concentrations of those two drugs, which would kill leukemia cells, was packaged into small microspheres, and this drug was developed as an alternative way of giving our standard chemotherapy with the hopes that it would offer lower side effects and more benefit. And indeed, I think with long-term follow-up, that's exactly what we're seeing. So in a similar group of patients, or slightly different, now we're talking about acute myeloid leukemia that's unfortunately has developed from other treatments or from something called myelodysplasia. That's often harder to treat, has a higher relapse risk. And, of course, the patients that it strikes may be of older age and may not be able to manage through standard chemotherapy might have greater risk. So this drug with long-term follow-up really has proven its case, has shown an improvement in survival, and a very significant improvement in response, and a lower side effect profile, saving a fraction of patients from serious complications. The suggestion was that this drug should now be moved into standard approach for such a situation, what we call secondary leukemia in someone of older age. I think there was quite a rigorous discussion about that, and I think we'll have to stay tuned to see how that settles into our practice. But I think the data is very nice with this novel approach or novel way of giving our current, what we consider standard drugs. Lastly, in AML, one of my colleagues actually presented data from a long-term study using a vaccine to help boost long-term remission rates after someone's been treated for AML. So this is a vaccine against something called WT1 or Wilms tumor 1, which is a gene that's not normally seen in normal tissues, but it's overexpressed in many cancers, acute myeloid leukemia, chronic leukemias, and several solid tumors. And by developing a vaccine or vaccinating people against a peptide or protein, which would make the body recognize this abnormal expression in cancer cells, we've been able to show, or our group at Sloan Kettering has been able to show, that this can be safely delivered. The patients can develop a specific immune response to this Wilms tumor 1 gene. And when patients did have immune responses, there seems to be an improvement in their ability to survive without their leukemia relapsing and their overall outcome, which is quite encouraging. Now, this is just the first look at this type of approach over long-term follow-up, but pivotal trials are now planned. This would be a very nice way to help over the long term keep patients in remission, having gained remission with standard treatment for AML. Let me switch now to ALL and talk to you about CAR T-cell therapy. Just a brief update on what has been a very exciting therapeutic development, which is engineered T-cells, taking a patient's own T cells delivering to them and allowing them to express a what's called a chimeric antigen receptor, something that allows them to recognize something on cancer cells, in this case specifically the something abnormal on the B cells present in chronic and acute lymphoid cancers, particularly ALL. We've learned a lot about this therapy. It can be an intense therapy that needs to be delivered in the hospital, but with very dramatic response in patients who have very little option in both acute and chronic lymphoid leukemias. So our group at MSK, presented by my colleague Jay Park, showed that depending on how we use it, we can get better responses. I think that what we learned in the research of patients treated with ALL is that if patients had smaller amounts of ALL present at the time of treatment versus more obvious or more evidence of their ALL by their bone marrow and blood tests, their chances of remission were higher and the chances of staying in remission were higher. We also saw that some of the side effects, and a severe inflammatory syndrome, which needs to be managed in the hospital but can be treated and managed, is more common when someone has higher amounts of their ALL present. Also, when we treat earlier or patients who have less of their ALL present, over time their relapse risk goes down. So what this is suggesting this is we may want to use this even earlier. And clearly we've learned how to use this type of therapy safer in the hospital with careful monitoring and managing this inflammatory syndrome called cytokine release. And this is really a breakthrough, harnessing our own immune system by engineering it a bit to help treat leukemia when it hasn't responded to what we would call chemotherapy and that can respond to immunotherapy. The University of Pennsylvania also presented an update on CAR T-cell therapy showing that when you look at it very logically by dosing of the T-cells, that the response does increase with the dose, but also that the inflammatory side effects of cytokine release syndrome needs to be tracked as well and can track similarly. So again, we're learning how to use this much smarter but with high rates of success and perhaps something we can move a bit earlier into our treatment armamentarium. I'll close with a report in CML and one last report on a cancer called blastic plasmacytoid dendritic cell neoplasm, or BPDCN, which is a rare cancer. But in CML, we saw one of the first reports of how successful can treatment-free remission be, meaning stopping treatment after a certain set of circumstances are present, meaning the patient achieves a remission on therapy, that remission is deep for a period of time, and they're determined to be safe and in the setting of a clinical trial to hold their therapy and be observed to see if they can maintain that remission without treatment. We saw the first report of a large study for patients who had Tasigna or nilotinib as their primary treatment. And suffice it to say, with now probably a little bit less overall treatment, with a median treatment of 3.5 years, the chances of staying off treatment and in remission, again, only under the right circumstances, when patients had a deep remission for 2 years in general and had treatment for at least 3 years, we saw more than 50% of patients at the one-year mark able to stay in relatively deep remission. Interestingly, about a quarter of patients had what's something called a withdrawal syndrome, where they had some mild and transient musculoskeletal symptoms. And importantly, of the other half of patients who maybe didn't retain their remission after stopping therapy, nearly all of them gained back a deep molecular remission, and the majority regained a very deep molecular remission. So I think what this is telling us is that we can think about in clinical trials and perhaps soon outside of clinical trials, under the right circumstances, after the right amount of treatment, whether CML may not need to be treated indefinitely, and that TKIs that are more potent may allow us to do it somewhat sooner and possibly with greater frequency, although I'm not sure whether we see a big difference between what we learned with imatinib versus nilotinib. Lastly, just a word on a drug to look out for called SL401 from a company called Stemline Therapeutics for a rare cancer called blastic plasmacytoid dendritic cell neoplasm, which is essentially a leukemia of a cell in the blood called a natural killer cell. Can be quite devastating and can occur in the skin, in the bone marrow, in the spleen, and act very much like a serious form of acute leukemia. A drug's been engineered to be an antibody against a common receptor or cytokine receptor, something that's on these cancer cells, conjugated to a toxin that delivers essentially a poison to the cancer cells. We saw nearly all patients respond in this cancer without a previous standard treatment. It was often treated with either myeloid or lymphoid induction chemotherapy, which carried, unfortunately, great side effects. As long as patients responded, they could get benefit. But this new drug offers a much lower toxicity option for this rare cancer, and shows us again that in leukemia in general, we're really able to develop better therapies, targeted therapies that can deliver selective therapies to the right targets, to activate the immune system and help it cooperate in the fight against cancer, and even the things that seem quite logical, like vaccines, can be developed, which could help keep cancer in remission. So the story in leukemia across the board was very positive, a few new developments, and I think much hope on the horizon for these novel approaches to cancer therapy. So thanks for your attention.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Morrow. That was excellent, and really lots of different types of leukemia that you addressed with lots of new treatments available. So thank you for that very much. And our next speaker is Dr. Ruben Mesa. Dr. Mesa is consultant hematologist, Mayo Clinic in Arizona. He is chair, Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology, deputy director, Mayo Clinic Cancer Center, professor of medicine, Mayo Clinic Cancer Center. And Dr. Mesa is going to be presenting highlights from ASCO on myeloproliferative neoplasms. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Mesa.
My thanks to Dr. Messner, as well as the ability to give a highlight today regarding the updates in myeloproliferative neoplasms at the American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting. The myeloproliferative neoplasms are a group of interrelated chronic bone marrow diseases that are a type of chronic leukemia that can affect people in a wide range of ways and include those diseases of essential thrombocythemia, polycythemia vera, and myelofibrosis. Now, as a frame of reference, the American Society of Clinical Oncology is probably the largest cancer-based meeting in the world, where physicians, scientists, practitioners, in particular from the U.S., come together to discuss updates in scientific progress across a spectrum of cancers, both of the blood as well as common cancers such as breast cancer, colon cancer, etc. Many of these updates are being presented as part of this discussion. Now, in terms of myeloproliferative neoplasms, I would first highlight that a key role of a meeting such as ASCO is first the education session, indeed where they gather a group of speakers, investigators in a field to have for the large audience there at ASCO a summary of key updates in the science, diagnosis, and care of patients with myeloproliferative neoplasms. And there, that session this year was chaired by myself and included Dr. Jeff Tyner from Oregon Health Sciences and Francesco Passamonte from Italy. And we worked to educate, discuss, and assist in the practice of, in particular, hematologists and medical oncologists in the United States regarding how to apply our evolving understanding of molecular markers in MPNs, both in their diagnosis as well as in estimating disease risk and sometimes therapy selection, particularly around the issue of stem cell transplantation. We then discussed the new agents in development as well as the long-standing information that has been favorable on ruxolitinib in myelofibrosis and polycythemia vera, medicines such as hydroxyurea and interferon, as well as how we weave these different therapies together in hopefully an individualized fashion to help patients who are afflicted with these diseases. Now, the second part of the meeting, I would say, is really informational, where we share scientific updates regarding the diseases on a variety of levels. This year, I'd highlight several key components which were discussed. The first, regarding issues of prognosis and risk. There was an important abstract presented by the MD Anderson group, led by Dr. Serge Rostovchik, where they were able to identify and reinforce the significant impact of a low platelet count for patients with myelofibrosis, in particular those that have a platelet count of less than 50,000 or even less than 100,000. It helps to identify for us individuals in which the disease is a bigger problem. There is greater risk. There is greater risk of the disease progressing, and certainly has implications in terms of how we optimally manage the disease. Next, I would highlight that there were two key sets of updates. First, regarding the long-term benefits of ruxolitinib. Second, a series of updates regarding pacritinib in myelofibrosis. But first, let's begin with ruxolitinib. We presented, on behalf of many of us from the COMFORT-1 study, myself, Dr. Rostovchik, Dr. Vikas Gupta, amongst others, the five-year update for individuals who had gone on the COMFORT-1 study. This was a key study that led to FDA approval of ruxolitinib in myelofibrosis, in the United States in particular. And on that trial, patients with myelofibrosis who had intermediate to or high-risk disease were randomized to ruxolitinib versus placebo. Now 5 years out, we see that about half of the patients remain on active ruxolitinib. Now that is really quite an accomplishment on a variety of levels. In particular, that the individuals that enrolled in this study were individuals that had very advanced disease, and the life expectancy of these individuals was probably well shorter than 5 years when they began on the study. So this durability of response, the fact that half of them remain on the therapy, benefiting with improvements in splenomegaly, in symptoms, is really very significant. Second, when we look at a very long-term set of data such as this, one of our goals is to identify issues of safety. Are there any unexpected side effects that we see for individuals that have been treated with the therapy for a long period of time? Overall, we find that there was not any surprises or unexpected toxicities, which would be more common by people being on the therapy longer. Overall, ruxolitinib is a very well-tolerated drug, and we identify that it can lower the red cell count and the platelet count. That we take into consideration with dosing. We have identified that there is a slightly higher risk of atypical infections, such as shingles, probably in the 3 to 5% range, not common, but not an irrelevant number either, and just something that we monitor for. There also may be a slight increased risk of skin cancers such as basal cell carcinomas or squamous cell carcinomas. This is at a very low rate. To be honest, it's a little difficult to distinguish amongst the rate that one might anticipate in individuals as they age, individuals that have previously been treated with hydroxyurea. But regardless, it is something that we track. So overall, I would view that those data were really quite favorable, clearly showing an impact and benefit for patients, as well as improved survival, and no evidence of any significant long-term toxicity. In addition to this, there was an interesting abstract presented by Francesco Passamonti, myself, and others, regarding a new clinical trial called the RETHINK trial. This is a trial looking at the utilization of ruxolitinib in patients with earlier myelofibrosis, those with low risk that have high-risk molecular features. We now know the therapy can have a real impact on the disease and that it's safe. And with that, we have tried to identify this group of individuals that may have a higher risk with the disease, that we see whether intervening with a JAK inhibitor earlier in the course of the disease would be impactful. Next, I would highlight several abstracts which were presented regarding pacritinib. Pacritinib is a FLT3 and JAK2 inhibitor, where we have previously demonstrated superiority to best alternative therapy when used for patients with, in particular, low platelet count in myelofibrosis. Now, pacritinib is of great interest because, one, it has shown significant activity in this difficult-to-group treat group of patients. But second, it is currently on an FDA clinical hold as the FDA analyzes the data from the study. Concerns raised because of the risk of death for patients participating in the clinical trials. Much analysis is ongoing to try to distinguish whether the risk of death being on the trial is related to the risk of passing away because of the severity of the disease, or whether it is related to the therapy itself. The analysis presented at ASCO shed definite light on this. One, we identified that there did not seem to be any higher risk of individuals passing away in the first 6 months between best alternative therapy and the pacritinib. Second, we identified that this trial, which had a 2-to-1 randomization, meaning 2/3 of the patients were treated with pacritinib, the arm of the trial in which patients were treated with pacritinib likely had a higher risk of passing away from the disease. They had higher white blood cell counts. They may have been closer to progressing toward acute leukemia. And with all of these factors, might be at higher risk of passing away. That could clearly confound the results. Next, we analyzed the impact of crossover. Many patients, the vast majority, crossed over in the trial between 24 to 36 weeks. So again, much analysis ongoing regarding the issues of safety, in that we had not identified any significant different risk of bleeding, cardiac events, or other side effects between the best alternative therapy and the pacritinib arm on the studies. It is clear that pacritinib may increase the risk of some GI side effects, but in general, they were pretty well tolerated. Now, in terms of benefits, this longer-term experience presented in the pacritinib abstracts was beneficial, with improvements in splenomegaly being durable, with improvement in symptoms seeming to increase over time as patients had a longer duration of exposure to the drug. Additionally, there were specific abstracts presented by Professor Claire Harrison regarding the ability of pacritinib to improve anemia and transfusion dependence in about a quarter of the patients enrolled in the study, as well as identifying that those individuals that began on the best alternative therapy arm, when they crossed over to pacritinib, they could develop an anemia response, their spleens would shrink, their symptoms would improve. So all of that really demonstrating the benefit of the therapy. Final mention I would make of updates at ASCO are drugs in development. There was an interesting abstract presented regarding the ongoing trial with imetelstat, early studies demonstrating the potential of deep responses in a segment of patients with myelofibrosis. There's currently an ongoing phase 2 clinical trial randomized between different doses of that medication to try to see the full impact, as well as trying to be mindful and diminish any potential toxicities. The agent seems to be very active, however, can drop the platelet count in a significant way and needs to be dosed cautiously regarding liver function. So again, many exciting updates regarding ruxolitinib, regarding pacritinib, regarding imetelstat in a setting that hopefully will lead to further exploration and further updates as this year evolves. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Messer. That was really excellent and very comprehensive in all the different types of myeloproliferative neoplasm. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Gregory Daniels. Dr. Daniels is Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine, University of California, San Diego, Rebecca and John Morris Cancer Center. And Dr. Daniels is going to present highlights from ASCO on melanoma. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Daniels.
Thank you, Carolyn. And I'd like to start with a shout-out. Shout-out for Carolyn Messner, who's, as she said, Cancer Care has been doing this for 27 years. And she's been doing it as long as I remember and does a great job trying to bring ASCO to everyone, trying to take an overwhelming amount of information and vocabulary and words and distill it down into something that we can all take home. Also like to shout out the patients and supporters, the people on the call, as well as all those patients who may have had an opportunity and chose that opportunity to participate in a clinical trial or continue to just push their oncologist and care providers for further answers to keep the field going forward. And lastly, I'd like to acknowledge my fellow speakers, because they've really, them as well as hundreds of other physicians and physician scientists, have really been pushing the field forward. And this year at ASCO, we had the pleasure of having our elected officials come in and outline the moonshot. And moonshot for cancer care, unless you've been someplace like the moon and haven't heard about it, is the initiative to really reinvigorate our goal of getting rid of cancer in our lifetime. And I'll just say, welcome aboard, that the rocket ship has taken off, and as far as I'm concerned, we just fired the second stage. And you've heard some of the discussion already from the presenters about new therapies, new diagnostics, new ways to treat cancer that have changed the standard of care and continue to push the field forward. So while I applaud the Moonshot program, what we really need help with is back down on the ground at Mission Control in terms of data sharing, data analysis, delivering better health care to a wide variety of people. And I think our elected officials realize this, that things are moving, and we have to take advantage of all the great science that's going on. So I'm just going to dive in there and reiterate some of the things that were said, which are some basics. We are having a better understanding as far as the genetic drivers of cancer, what are the insides of the cells that have gone haywire, as well as what's going on the outside of the cells in the microenvironment. And you've heard many reference to immune therapy, and this is tapping into those cells that are around the tumor, that are supporting the tumor, and how we can change the microenvironment of the tumor to ultimately get to a third stage of the rocket, which is going to be precision oncology, where we can direct these treatments more accurately to the patients, probably with combinations or sequential therapies, and then finally reach our goal, which is treatment-free survival. So I'll start with the themes and my goals. For melanoma, ASCO's been a whirlwind of several years, but I'll say this year was a maturation of that whirlwind. The storm has settled down, and we're looking around and seeing where we're at. And so we had several large clinical trials that were groundbreaking and have now given us some longer-term data where we can sit down with patients and with better support say, this is likely the best treatment path for you. And I'll get back to that. The focus in melanoma is now on durability and overall survival, and trying to match the patient with the quote-unquote best treatments. And there was a lot of discussion back and forth as to what constitutes the best treatment. We have clinical trial endpoints that are terms, as you heard throughout the call, progression-free survival, overall survival. But I'll just say that most patients that come into clinic, while they're looking for the overall survival, their next question really is, well, how are the treatments going to impact me? How long do I have to take these treatments? And, of course, the goal. So melanoma, I'm going to primarily focus on cutaneous melanoma. This is the majority of the melanomas out there, but I'll just mention to those people, few that may be on the call thinking about ocular or mucosal melanoma, I'm not going to state anything specific to those two classes of melanoma, but focus on skin melanoma. And melanoma, wherever it occurs, is the process where a normal pigment-producing cell, the melanocyte, gains that ability to become a cancer. And again, that's going to be dependent on both that short-circuiting, the driver mutations that we now understand inside the cancer cell, inside the melanocyte, as well as that microenvironment that's supporting the melanoma. So I'll jump into, as Dr. Mesa outlined, that there are educational sessions. And two leaders in the field in melanoma in both immune therapy and targeted therapies are Dr. Anthony Rebus at UCLA and Dr. Keith Flaherty. And they took on a quote-unquote great debate of which is better, immune therapy or targeted therapy. I just want to say from the get-go, there is no correct answer here, that there are many factors that the physician that's treating you or part of your care team needs to take into account when deciding which treatment to go first or second or third or in combination. But Dr. Rebus jumped in and reminded us that those molecules that have been mentioned for lung cancer and pancreatic cancer are active in melanoma. These include molecules that inhibit these breaks or checks in the immune system. CTLA-4 is one, PD-1, PD-L1 is another one. And both of these checkpoints have been used singly or in combination across multiple tumor types. And in melanoma, they have some dramatic, if not described as amazing, impact. And so Dr. Rebus' hypothesis was that while we call it immune therapy, we really should think of it also as targeted therapy, that the T cell is very specific for an antigen, which is a marker on tumor, and that T cell can be released with these immune modulators. So the T cell he thinks of, or was hypothesizing, we should think of as a targeted therapy. So it was a clever play of both worlds, using immune therapy and targeted therapy in the same speech, as well as updating us on the information so far showing very durable and high rates of response for single-agent immune therapies. He brought up, as this was a debate, the counter-argument that sometimes there are some consequences to our treatments, and it's possible that targeted therapies with the BRAF and MEK, which I'll talk about in a second, may have consequences for subsequent immune treatment. And he presented some data showing resistant signatures in patients who have been treated with BRAF-MEK. This is incredibly important as we think about sequencing these treatments as to which should come first. And it's still a debate. And so Dr. Flaherty counterpunched in his argument with data from the COMBI-D study, which is looking at drugs of dabrafenib and trametinib. Again, these are BRAF and MEK inhibitors, showing high response rates and durable response. And his conclusion was that if you know the genetics of the inside of the cell, we now have these tools that are proven and validated for quick, durable responses in patients with the need for a response, namely those with metastatic disease. And so he suggested, though, that immune therapy was second to targeted treatment. So this debate will continue until a large clinical trial is completed, and that's led by ECOG, that's looking at people with melanoma in the metastatic disease being randomized to either these targeted treatments first, followed subsequently by immune therapies, or vice versa, and looking at the sequence and if it matters. A more important outcome from this study, though, I think, is going to be looking at markers that best tell us which treatments match to which patients, and I'll comment on that again. So as far as the few studies that I will focus on, one is the COMBI-D trial. This was a phase 3 study presented, the update was presented by Dr. Flaherty, and it's looking at patients with a BRAF mutation in cutaneous melanoma. And as you heard, these BRAF mutations also occur in some other tumor types, such as colorectal cancer. This was a almost 1,000 patient study which enrolled patients who were screened for BRAF mutations up front and randomized to either what was the standard of care at that moment, which was single-agent BRAF inhibitor, or dabrafenib, compared to the double-agent inhibitor, dabrafenib and trametinib, or BRAF-MEK, and then looking at the analysis of progression-free survival and overall survival. And just as we saw last year, where separation of the curves happened very early, there was continuation of that separation favoring combination therapy for both progression-free survival and overall survival, such that it's now become the new standard of care for patients who it makes sense to give them a targeted therapy up front. We should be thinking about combination of BRAF-MEK, whether it's the dabrafenib-trametinib. There's a similar data set out there with vemurafenib and cobimetinib, another BRAF-MEK combination. Interestingly, he presented some new data showing that those patients that had a loss of a particular gene may have a poorer progression-free and overall survival when treated with these drugs. So while everybody had a BRAF mutation, if they had a second mutation, and this was called CDKN2A, if they had a second gene mutation, that this significantly was associated with significantly worse outcomes for patients. And so it may help us think about which treatments come first, even in those BRAF mutated patients. So conclusions were BRAF-MEK does lead to long-lasting, durable, progression-free survival and overall survival, and their data is out now 3 years with a substantial number of patients continuing to benefit from the medications. The next combination is on the other side of the debate, and that's in immune therapies. And you've heard these terms before, nivolumab, ipilimumab. We're all getting used to saying them because they're prevalent now across all oncology. And nivolumab is a PD-1 inhibitor. Ipilimumab is a CTLA-4 inhibitor. And Jed Wolchuk, another seminal figure in current oncology who's helped really delineate the importance of these pathways clinically, updated us on the CheckMate 067 clinical trial. Again, this was another very large clinical trial, approximately 1,000 patients randomized between either one immune checkpoint versus another immune checkpoint versus the combination. And these patients were randomized and blinded in the clinical trial. So same type of endpoints, progression-free survival and overall survival. And last year we saw some interesting data separating the curves out, showing that patients who had a particular biomarker fared well. So if they were positive for what's called PD-L1 on the tumor cells, if that expression was high, they fared well regardless of if you did PD-1 blockade or PD-1 and CTLA-4 blockade. But both those arms did substantially better than the CTLA-4 blockade alone, namely ipilimumab. And this data now with further follow-up continues to show the same information and has solidified in our treatment algorithms, at least thinking about immune therapies, pushing the PD-1 blockers or the combination of PD-1 and CTLA-4 above single-agent ipilimumab or CTLA-4 blockade by itself. So it appears that if we are going to treat somebody that with an immune therapy, that either a drug like nivolumab or pembrolizumab in the front line or the combination of nivolumab and ipilimumab appears better than just doing ipilimumab. So this is really exciting data showing the durability of response. There were patients that are continuing on these medications well past two-year mark. So another clinical trial, KEYNOTE-001, looked at pembrolizumab, and Caroline Robert presented this. This is a very large phase one clinical trial. So most of the time phase one studies are just tens of patients. This phase one, once it got going, ultimately ended up enrolling 655 patients over a two-year period as they continued to define their treatment doses and schedules. And so at the end of this phase one, we had a large amount of information about what's the best dosing schedule to give to patients with pembrolizumab. And Dr. Robert presented a composite follow-up from the 655-patient study, again showing an update to that durable overall survival and progression-free survival. I thought the most exciting part of the presentation, though, for me was what happened longer term with those patients that get a complete response. And complete response is defined as a disappearance of any measurable target lesion that we can find on our scans or physical exam. So in a sense, this would be the equivalent of your doctor saying, I just can't find any more cancer to treat. So that's a complete response. And a portion of the patients that were treated on this study with pembrolizumab achieved a complete response. And subsequently, a fraction of them went on to stop the medication. This is such an important question because patients who are on these immune therapies and achieve a response, we don't quite know yet if it's safe to stop. And so having these clinical trials with this long follow-up has been so valuable. And she found that in more than of the patients who had a complete response, more than half of them ended up stopping the medication. And she outlined that the median time of treatment for these complete responders was about 2 years, and that those that went off treatment, she had data for an average of about 10 months, and of those that went off for that average time, she only had a very small number, which is actually one patient out of her whole group, that achieved a complete response that stopped the pembrolizumab that went on to actually have the cancer come back. So flip side is she had more than 90% of her group who achieved that complete response, came off drug, continued to maintain it on an average of more than 10 months. This is really exciting because this is the endpoint that we've all been striving for, treatment-free, durable survival. And I'm really looking forward to next year's update on where those patients are. I'll say one more keynote study. This is the 006 study. This was pembrolizumab versus ipilimumab. Again, there's so much going on in these large clinical trials, but this was a pembrolizumab versus ipilimumab trying to define the standard of care for patients. And now, again, we have more than 2 years of data to look back on and say that yes, for overall survival, it does look like a PD-1 or pembrolizumab in this case inhibitor appears better in the front line than using ipilimumab or a CTLA-4 inhibitor. My only caveat with looking at this data is that during the time that this study was going, both medications were not available to patients. And so those, when we're looking at overall survival, we have to be careful about the time that the study was conducted and what treatments were available for the patients. So those patients who were getting pembrolizumab on that clinical trial who then subsequently needed something else could go over to ipilimumab. However, that wasn't necessarily the case for those patients on ipilimumab. They could not necessarily go over to pembrolizumab because it was not FDA approved at that point. So a little caution in some of the conclusions of this trial, but it's another one that reinforces the idea that starting with a PD-1 inhibitor may be a better strategy than starting with a CTLA-4 inhibitor. So there was a lot of information, and you've heard some of it, on trying to better characterize the patients as to who benefits from which therapy. I'll just say that more is to come on that. And the take-home medications that I have from ASCO was that defining the best treatment continues. We'll get there soon with more long-term follow-up from these clinical trials, that we're getting to a point where clinical predictors and molecular characterizations are going to help us direct treatments better, and we're transitioning from one old standard of care, which you kind of heard about, the chemo, radiation, and surgery, to a new one that integrates in these targeted therapies and immune therapies. So I look forward to the next ASCO and discussions where additional combinations will come out and we'll be better able to target these to achieve that ultimate goal. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Daniels. That was really outstanding and really just an outstanding presentation on melanoma, but also wrap up of the entire our entire series and actually of ASCO as well. in terms of looking forward to the future and also looking at how treatments are evolving. And so it's very helpful to our participants. And thank you so much for being really such a long-term participant on these programs and speaking so eloquently. Thank you. And I want to thank all of our speakers. They've really been outstanding. This has been rather an amazing series, a two-part series, and I want to remind all of you this is a one-hour workshop, and that, and actually this is a one-and-a-half. Today we did, actually it was a 90-minute workshop. We extended the workshop a bit today because we wanted to be sure to cover everything today. However, from ASCO, however, I recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour, so I do want to remind all of you that there are many services that you can access after the program ends. And so for those of you who still may have some questions, medical questions, in terms of your care and your treatment, of course you want to go to your healthcare team, of course. But if you wish to actually consult other places as well, we often recommend that people call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237 or visit their website at www.cancer.gov. And, of course, always in conjunction with your healthcare team to bring back information that you learned both from our program today as well as any information you might get from contacting the National Cancer Institute. And for those of you who might like to access the free psychosocial support services from Cancer Care, which means our counseling services, an opportunity to talk with one of our oncology social workers about your concerns, any practical or financial issues that you may be struggling with, also we offer telephone and online support groups, and those are wonderful both for people. The online groups particularly reach both people in the United States and internationally as well, and with international participants on the call today, just a reminder that that service is available to all of you on the call today, as well as our counseling services. And also, of course, we have many more of these workshops coming up and many publications that you can access. And I do want to call out to all of you a particular workshop that we have coming up on precision medicine and cancer treatment on June 29th, it's a Wednesday, from 1:30 to 2:45 p.m. Eastern Time. And that might be of interest to all of you because it is a theme that you're hearing more and more of. Most importantly, as we conclude the program today, I don't want any one of you to feel that you're alone in coping with cancer, with coping with a family member's cancer. I want you to know that you're now part of the cancer care world, and to some extent that means that we're simply a telephone call away or a mouse click away on your computer, and you can access our services either way. You can call us at 1-800-813-4673, or you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org, and our oncology social workers will take questions from you also for service on our website as well. Again, I want to thank you for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone have a wonderful day.